brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We were saying that my friends, their desires, their pleasures, if I come in contact with them, they will become mine. For example, sometimes you're not into cars at all, but you become friends who are in love with cars. And then what happens is over time, you find yourself loving cars as well. When you come in contact with the friends who like a certain type of food, after a while, you find yourself liking that type of food and vice versa. So their desires becomes mine. So if I associate myself with people and friends who their main aim in life is to fulfill their desires, I will be like them. And if I find friends whose their aim is to fulfill the pleasures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then I will be like them. So a bad friend could also lead a person to becoming animalistic in his passions and his desires. To the extent that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, even in the Quran, says in chapter Al-Furqan in verse 28, he says, Ya waylati, ya laytani lam attakhudhu fulanan khalila. Oh Allah, I wish that in this life I never took so-and-so as a friend. Why? Allah continues and he says, لَقَدْ أَضَلَّنِي عَنِ الذِّكْرِ. He made me forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. بَعْدَ إِذْ جَاءَنِي. After this remembrance of Allah has came to me. Why was this person driven by his friends away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Obviously, because he was driven towards his passions and desires. So there are two roads. There is the road of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then there is the road of shaitan. The road of shaitan is full of passions and desires. The road of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is full of obedience to Allah. Yes, we are meant to indulge in desires. Yes, we are meant to have our passions, but they are meant to be controlled by us, maintained, refined, and used in appropriate to our living, not too extreme. They don't become the goal of our life. Rather, they should be the means. Let us take a short break, and then we'll continue right after.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we were saying one of the causes and reasons that motivates me to being indulging or to indulge myself too much into pleasures and desires is the fact that there are bad friends that I associate myself with. And even the concept of friend and friendship is very important, that the Quran has given it or has gave it plenty of mention. The ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, they have explained what friends and friendship is and how we should choose friends, because it is a very thin line between going with someone who will take you to heaven and going with someone who will take you to hell. Because bad and evil people are the ones who indulge and desires only, who their aim and mission in life is to please themselves with money, women, cars, houses, entertainment, whatever, even sometimes sleep itself. You know, some people, they just love to sleep too much. And if this happens, then obviously I'm going the wrong path. Sometimes now we, even in the world of social media, if you meet the wrong friends, you would stay, some people say, over 8, 9, 10 hours with their friends online, either playing a game or watching videos or doing stupid things that waste their life and keeps them away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which defeats the purpose of this life itself. We're not meant to live this life, so we just please ourselves. With the pleasures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that's provided for me and you, were meant to be used as means to get us to Him. I eat food to survive. I have sexual desire so I could continue the race of mankind. I use wealth to feed myself and my family. I do this to do that. So you can see that every pleasure and desire that Allah has given us, He said, there's a wisdom behind it. Use it correctly. Don't overindulge. Because overindulging, you will definitely miss the point and you will lose the path. So brothers and sisters, keep in mind that my friends and your friends, they play a huge role in our lives. That if you find yourself seeking too much pleasures and desires, your friends could be the cause. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
یا سجاد.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has highlighted the stance of the resistance front in addition to the significant achievements accomplished in the past 40 years.
One of our duties in the future is to strengthen the strategies of deterrence to protect Lebanon's people, land, state, sovereignty and dignity, and natural resources and treasures.
The most pressing matter awaiting the resistance, he said, was the issue of maritime resources.
The main and current challenge that we're facing now and the few upcoming days is the issue of gas and petrol and the demarcation of the maritime borders. I will not say anything new. We have said everything that we should say. Now we're all waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, we always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics expressed concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma Al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation in Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage.
Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market.
From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they are just representing their tablo rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that their colors are faded by passing the time.
Representing Iran's heritage and civilization for thousands of years, the Persian carpet has for the past two decades disappeared from many floors and walls. Producers hope that this exhibition would act as a wake-up call for Iranian authorities to take action and dust off all the challenges from the Persian carpet. Yusuf Jalalib, Tehran.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore, they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony of human beings is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, US President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the U.S. and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the U.S. doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the U.S. sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The U.S. should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry, and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in the Malian capital, Bamako, on the first leg of his African tour, which will later take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar. Amir Abdollahian is heading a high-ranking political and economic delegation. A group of representatives of several private sector companies also accompanies him during his visit. The top diplomat was welcomed by his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop. Upon arrival at Bamako's international airport, the Malian foreign minister called the visit a sign of Iran's will to enhance ties with the African country. Amir Abdollahian confirmed that Tehran seeks all-out expansion of relations with Mali and has special plans for this purpose.
I am confident that we will start a new chapter of relations between Tehran and Mali under the government of President Raisi.
The visit is part of a wider policy roadmap in Iran. The foreign ministry says Tehran is looking to expand ties with African nations, including Mali, in the fields of economy, banking, and trade.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a recent finding, 24% of sewage overflow pipes at popular seaside resorts in England and Wales have monitors that are faulty or do not have monitors at all, meaning people could be swimming in human waste this summer without realizing it. We are prepared for you an article written jointly by Pippa Crera and Helena Horton. The piece is titled, Liz Truss Has Sewage on Her Hands Over UK Environment Agency Cuts. The Guardian can reveal the UK Tory leadership frontrunner Liz Truss was responsible for cutting millions of pounds of funding earmarked for tackling water pollution during her time as Environment Secretary. Liz Truss, who was in charge of the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, between 2014 and 2016, oversaw efficiency plans set out in the 2015 spending review to reduce Environment Agency funding by £235 million. According to the National Audit Office, this included a £24 million cut from a government grant for environment protection, including surveillance of water companies to prevent the dumping of raw sewage between 2014 and 2015 and 2016 and 2017. It represents almost a quarter of the funding cut from this area between 2010 when the grant stood at £120 million, and 2020, by which time the grant had fallen to £40 million. Labour analysis of official figures shows that since 2016, raw sewage discharge in England and Wales has more than doubled, from 14.7 spill events and overflow to 29.3 in 2021. Greenpeace said the figures showed Liz Truss had sewage on her hands. The Environment Agency has called for the British government to reverse the cuts, but campaigners want the next Prime Minister to go even further and also give the body the power to properly monitor water companies over sewage, rather than allowing them to self-report sewage discharges. It follows the finding that 24% of sewage overflow pipes at popular seaside resorts in England and Wales have monitors that are either faulty or do not have monitors at all, meaning people could be swimming in human waste this summer without even realizing it. Last year, the head of the Environment Agency, James Bevan, called on the British government to reinstate the funds, saying that given the length of the country's river systems, having only a few hundred people to oversee them is pretty a tall ask. James Bevan told MPs, It has had an effect on our capacity to monitor, to enforce the rules and to help improve the environment where we think it needs doing. Honestly, I would like to see that grant restored. I would like to get back to where we were 10 years ago, and I think it would make a massive difference. In response to the findings, the Shadow Environment Secretary, Jim McMahon, said, "The country is facing a crisis in our water supply. Our water infrastructure is at bursting point, with billions of litres of water being wasted every day and raw sewage being dumped into our waters." Jim McMahon added, "The fact that Liz Truss was the one to cut the Environment Agency so severely not only demonstrates her lack of foresight, but also her lack of care for the detail in recognizing the need to adapt to the serious flooding that has just happened on her watch." Environment Agency insiders said that after Liz Truss's cuts, staff were moved away from environment monitoring towards flood protection, and the number of samples taken from rivers went down dramatically. Brogan Lewis, a senior consultant for Environment Agency, told The Guardian, "They plummeted to the point it was impossible for the agency to know what's going on. They had no control or monitoring capability that was meaningful. They ceded the control of monitoring to water companies, which ended up being able to mark their own homework. They take their own samples and assess whether they are being compliant." Brogan Lewis added, "We saw that doesn't work. Look what happened with Southern Water, which didn't declare its pollution incidents and ended up being fined by the Environment Agency when they were found out. There are suspicions this could be happening across the board. It has been left to citizen scientists who monitor and fill in the gaps." Rogan Lewis added, "Lots of this would have happened under Liz Truss. She was there when some of those cuts were made. She was a poor minister and the Environment Agency has been cut to the bone and it can't monitor or regulate effectively." As Environment Secretary, Liz Truss defended the cuts by claiming, "There are ways we can make savings as a department," citing better use of technology and interagency working. She is already facing questions about why she was registered absent from a vote on a Labour amendment in the House of Commons that aimed to place legal obligations on water companies to stop polluting England's waterways during heavy rainfall. Greenpeace UK's chief scientist, Dr. Doug Parr, said, "A decade of budget cuts and government deregulation has left the Environment Agency almost literally up Sewage Creek without a paddle. The growing tsunami of sewage unleashed onto Britain's waterways is a shocking demonstration of how undermining our regulators leads to a disregard for nature and those meant to protect it." Dr. Doug Parr added, "That our likely future Prime Minister was an instigator of cuts to the money used to protect our rivers and so help cause this environmental catastrophe doesn't bode well for Britain's protection of the natural world. Liz Truss has sewage on her hands." Hugo Tagholm, the chief executive of Surfers Against Sewage, said, "Self-monitoring has clearly failed for the water industry. The culture of self-reporting has clearly failed. Millions of hours of sewage pollution going into our waterways every year. It's a failed model." Martin Salter from the Angling Trust said, "The consequences of these ill-advised cuts to the Environment Agency's pollution monitoring capabilities are now present for all to see and smell. With raw sewage flowing down our rivers and dead fish and other wildlife washed up under banks of rivers with depressing regularity." Martin Salter added, "The move away from tougher regulation in favour of allowing water companies to report on their own failures has created a polluter's charter, as evidenced by the recent prosecution of Southern Water for deliberately falsifying their discharge data. The Environment Agency has long bemoaned its lack of funding and its lack of power, underpinned by a lack of ambition from ministers on tackling waste. In 2020, it said it recognised that a huge gap is opening up between the outcomes that they want to achieve and their ability to achieve them, and estimated that at the current rate of progress, it would take more than 200 years to reach the government's target of at least 75% of waters being close to their natural state.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, ulama, and authors all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi, and another from the University of Qom, Dr. Fakh Rouhani. Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So in the new series of the program, The Teacher, in the month of Muharram and Safar, we try to dedicate our programs and episodes of the program, The Teacher, to the authors who spend their time in compiling books about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's why for today, we want to talk about one of the greatest and maybe from among the early generation of the authors who authored and compiled a book regarding the history of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the day of Ashura. He is no one but Abu Mekhnaf. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's start with you, brother. First, give us the background or a little bit biography of Abu Mekhnaf, and then we'll get to his magnum opus, Maqtal al-Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Abu Mekhnaf, as you mentioned, to be honest, based on his biography, we don't know much. Mm-hmm. Because, as you mentioned, he is regarded as one of the early historians who wrote about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and generally wrote about the Islamic history.
Yes.
So when we refer to the historical records, we see that actually his time span is mentioned from 80 after Hijrah up until 157. So
that's right. Yeah, so he was born,
middle of the second century.
So he was born maybe 90 years after the story of Ashura and Karbala, isn't it?
Based on this historical record, right. Okay. It is regarded. Yeah, you can consider it that way. That 20 years.
20 years now.
Yes, 20 years. Yes, 20 years after the tragedy of Karbala, he was born.
Okay.
But when we go and refer to the historical books and records, we see that some have regarded him as the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, mm-hmm. alayhi salam. Some other have regarded him as the companions of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. But it is possible to say more reliable.
That's right.
Record that is going to regard him as the companions of Imam Sadiq. And yes. We see this record is more fitting his time spent. Why? Because we see that his death time is recorded or is reported as 157, and we have Imam Sadiq being martyred exactly on 148.
Okay,
so almost 10 years after the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, he also passed away.
That's all right.
So based on these historical reports, we can say that he is regarded as one of the second century historians who wrote about Imam Hussein's tragedy. So his report and his record could be regarded as one of the genuine and very, very fresh record to the tragedy of Karbala. That's why we see many historians after him, including Tabari, the most important Sunni historian, is going to quote almost the whole chapter of Karbala from his report.
Meaning that
what he has wrote regarding the tragedy of Karbala or has been delivered through the book of Tabari is not the whole historical books or historical records that Abu Mukhnaf has written in this regard.
That's right. Okay. So, Dr. Fakhrani, in this way, Abu Mukhnaf is considered as a historiographer, isn't it?
Yes.
A historian, a person who wrote many books and authored so many outstanding manuscripts on the history of Islam, including Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. So, you as a researcher on Ashura literature, how did you find the work of Abu Mukhnaf as the first one? Is it believed to be the first one, isn't it?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I have to thank you and thank Mr. Mahdavi's contributions. In this regard, it must be indicated that among the sources available, among the earliest sources available, Abu Mukhnaf is certainly one of such sources. However, it's believed that he was preceded by a person named Asbagh ibn Nubateh al-Majashi'i.
That's right.
Okay? Asbagh ibn Nubateh, who was a companion of Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and who was a resident of Kufa, must be in a better situation in order to gather first-hand information from the people who were over there.
That's right.
Okay? However, Asbagh ibn Nubateh was reportedly an old man. He was too old to take part in the battle of Karbala on Ashura.
Okay.
At the same time, it must be indicated that at that time, rewriting history in the present sense of the term wasn't common. Rather, at that time, when we look at the books and historical documents indicated, we find that they are either event-oriented or personality-oriented.
That's right.
That is, for example, Waqat al-Siffin is event-oriented, okay, of Nasr ibn Muzahim is event-oriented, or Maqtal al-Hussein is personally-oriented, okay?
Yes. Okay?
And these books should be regarded as chronicles. For example, in this year, such and such, for example, events took place. Or within this year, for example, in this season, this event took place, and
That's so right.
on. They go on in this way. At the same time, it must be indicated that one of the important points regarding Abu Mukhnaf is that he tried to interview either those who were available or either those who were present on the plain of Karbala or, for example, a person who was present in the time on the plain of Karbala, but he died, okay?
Okay.
Now, Abu Mukhnaf went to his elder son, okay? Uh-huh. Tell me what your father had told you regarding his experience in Karbala.
Okay.
And from this perspective, we find that
So reports, you mean? A kind of reports.
I should like to say that no. Abu Mukhnaf was, a person who had adopted much earlier than, Western scholars, research procedures. It was his adoption it was his, I should like to say that his sagacity, to have adopted an interview-based history or field research in this regard. So from this perspective, we can say that he was after finding, first-hand reports. But at the same time, some of these reports may sound not to be that much harmonious with each other, but he did his best in this regard.
That's all right. And was it in the shape of a book at the first look, or no, there were some papers here and there, and then, for example...
No, some notes and papers.
The next generations were changed it into in a revision form, an edition form into a book.
Yes, if you, for example, if you consider, for example, very important historical documents or even religious records, you find that, okay, they can rarely be found to be in the form of several chapters or several paragraphs, okay? The That's whole right. text is continuous, and it's like a running on text, okay?
Okay, that's all right.
I mean, intertextual divisions mm-hmm. should be, I mean, later developments, I mean, applied in the case of books. That's However, right. content-wise, it's believed that Abu Mekhnaf was amongst the, I mean, earliest generations of those people who endeavored to come up with a history of what took place on Ashura.
That's all right, on the day of Ashura. I'll get back to you asking some questions about the main content. Now, Sheikh Mahtavi, so these are some, can say, several reports that has to be gathered and then changed into a shape of the book. And the next generation of the scholars and ulama of the Shiite world, you know, has changed it into a book called Al-Maqtal al-Husayn, isn't it? So talk a little bit about this authenticity of the reports in this book for us.
As I think briefly it was mentioned in our program so far, we have to come to this point that today we cannot say we have one authentic book which has been written by Abu Mekhnaf as Waqat al-Taf.
That's right.
Whatever we have right now is the piece of the documents and reports and records which is found in Tariq Tabari and Al-Irshad, the Sheikh Mufid.
Okay.
Two scholars, better to say scholars, because Tabari is mainly known as the historians who has been living during the 4th century. He passed away around, 310. So mainly the things that we have regarding Maqtal Abu Mekhnaf is the records and reports that was gathered by Tabari in his book.
That's right.
Tariq al-Rusul. The full name of his book is Tariq al-Rusul wal-Muluk.
That's right.
And the other book that we can find some other reports and records in is the Al-Irshad, which is written by Sheikh Mufid, the Shia scholar who is living during the who passed away in 413.
You mean these two outstanding scholars, I mean Tabari and Sheikh al-Mufid, we can say reported from Abu Mekhnaf, isn't it?
They had direct access to the
text.
Yes,
that's right.
Whatever today we know as Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf. So it's better to say what we are going to take and open and read and refer to as Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf today is not the same thing that has been gathered by Abu Mekhnaf himself.
That's right.
This is after one generation, and then they quote whatever they had in their access.
That's right.
I mean, Tabari and Sheikh Mufid.
Yes.
And today we have some of the authors, mainly in Farsi, as Mr. Gharavi. He gathered and compiled.
Yusufi Gharavi.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. He compiled all things which are quoted from Maqtal Abi Mekhnaf in both books, Tabari and Al-Irshad, and he put it in the form of book.
So this is a comparative study, as you said, isn't it?
It could be said in one sense, not in a sense that it's kind of comparative studies that, okay, you are going to drop some sorts and then put some other sorts in your book.
Okay.
Just gather as much as possible from two sources, whatever which is quoted from Abu Mekhnaf.
That's all right. And Dr. Fakhwani, are there several, for example, Arabic revisions of the book available in the markets too about Abu Mekhnaf?
Yes.
You know, what are they?
Yes, but in the beginning it must be indicated that the seminal contribution of Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi lies in the fact that he has reconstructed Abu Mekhnaf's account.
Okay, how?
Yeah, I mean, as Mr. Mahdavi indicated, he compared and contrasted various versions of Tabari and Sheikh Mufid.
Mm-hmm.
Tabari's history book and Sheikh Mufid's book, Kitab al-Irshad. And for the attention, for further information of the audience, I should like to mention that both of these books have been translated into English. Tabari's book was translated in several volumes published in America, if I'm not mistaken, by Columbia University, if I'm not mistaken. And Kitab al-Irshad was also published, translated into English from the Arabic original, and its translator was Jan Howard, who was a British scholar of Arabic literature. That's and right. His translation, his English translation, was published in London in 1981, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
However, it must be indicated that prior to Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi's reconstructed account, there were several other Arabic versions, commonly known as Abu Mekhnafa. However, they had some discrepancies. At times, for example, this version was in stark difference from another version.
Yes.
And this was one of the impetus for Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Yusufi Gharavi to work out a reconstructed version of it. But for your information, I should like to say that in lesser than 8 or 10 years ago, Imam Al Hussein's Holy Shrine, its publication, research and publication division, published a book in 3 volumes, Mawsu'at Al Maqatil Al Husseiniyya, Encyclopedia of Imam Hussein's Maqtals, Imam Hussein's martyrdom accounts. In this book, which is available in Arabic in 3 volumes, various accounts of martyrdom of Imam Al Hussein alayhi salam are indicated. To my amazement, I found a version entitled The Maqtal, written by Al-Mujashi'i. Granted that there had been various versions of the same book bearing the title Abu Mekhnaf's account. What's important in this regard is that it shows that the martyrdom of Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam was really very, thought-provoking event, such that even in the harshest times of the Umayyad dynasty, and particularly Abbasid dynasty, some important historians devoted the energies to this case.
Right.
But at the same time, I should like to say that perhaps it was because of some historians who were, in fact, court historians, that they were able to reconstruct the event of Karbala in terms of some earlier generations of those people who taken part in the event. Other than this, from the point of the hadiths, we can rarely find any details about martyrdom of Imam Al-Hussein al-Sahab.
That's all right. And this is the role of the committed historians.
Yes.
To the history of Islam and the Shiite bulls, we can say, who dedicated their life in narrating the story, especially the story and the narrative of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, called Maqtal al-Hussein, which are in different variations and different scholars. And inshallah, in our upcoming session, we'll dedicate the program, the teacher, to the other authors too, who spend their time. Thank you so much, Dr. Farhwani, for a nice elaboration. Sheikh Mahdavi, thank you so much. Brother, it was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, talking about Abu Mekhnaf, the author of Maqtal al-Hussein. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.